Support for the Exchange Podcast comes from you, our sustaining members, and from New Hampshire School Administrators Association, representing school superintendents and administrators, championing the education of children in our state every day since 1941. In today's ever-changing world, public education matters, and so does its leaders. Online at nhsaa.org.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, in for Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Coronavirus has appeared in New Hampshire, and people are nervous. Can the spread of coronavirus and the disease it causes, COVID-19, be stopped? Who is most vulnerable, and what, if anything, should people be doing now to prepare? In this hour, we're going to take your calls and emails about coronavirus. What questions do you have? Email exchange@nhpr.org or call 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also post on our Facebook page. You can find it at NHPR Exchange. That's all one word. That's also where we're broadcasting a live video of this radio program today. Again, 1-800-892-6477. If you've got a pressing question about coronavirus on your mind, joining us this hour to answer your questions, Dr. Benjamin Chan, state epidemiologist for New Hampshire, Dr. Elizabeth Talbot, an infectious disease specialist at Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center. She's also state deputy epidemiologist, and NHPR healthcare reporter Jason Moon. Thanks all of you for being here. Really appreciate it.
Good morning, Peter.
Glad to be here.
Thank you.
So let's get a lay of the land first. Dr. Chan, right now, how many people have been diagnosed with coronavirus in New Hampshire, and what do we know about how they got the virus?
Yeah, so we have two individuals diagnosed with the new coronavirus in New Hampshire. As I'm sure many people are aware at this point, the first individual was announced on Monday of this week. That was an adult who had traveled to Italy, returned to New Hampshire, and then several days after their return presented with symptoms consistent with what we're calling COVID-19. That's coronavirus disease 2019. That initiated a contact investigation to identify people who are close contacts of that individual, because that's how this disease is primarily spread. And in the course of our contact investigation, we asked people that were close contacts to self-quarantine themselves and monitor for symptoms. One of those individuals developed symptoms also of COVID-19, and so we tested them, and that individual came back on Tuesday testing with a presumptive positive.
Mm-hmm. And can you define close contact for us? Like, we're in a studio together. We're, 7 feet apart or so? Is that considered close contact?
So it's important to remember that this is a virus, a new coronavirus that is spread very similarly to influenza. Right? It's spread primarily from an infected person through respiratory droplets. And so it requires what we call close contact, which involves longer duration contact within 6 feet of someone who is infected in order to potentially be exposed to this new virus.
Mm-hmm. We've got a couple of basic questions from listeners about what we know and what we don't know about the virus, Dr. Chan. So feel free to say if you don't know yet about these questions, but I want to go through them. If you're infected with COVID-19, how long do you stay contagious?
Yeah, that's a great question and something we've been getting a lot of questions about. And I think it's still unclear at this point. What's happening if and when someone is identified with COVID-19 is that the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is recommending serial mouth and nose swabs and testing to identify when the virus clears from the respiratory passage. What we've heard preliminarily from the CDC is this could take up to a couple of weeks after someone becomes symptomatic for them to clear their virus, but it's certainly possible that it could occur sooner. We don't have a lot of information on this, and it's one of the active areas of investigation by the CDC and different health departments around the state that are identifying cases.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Talbot, I wanted to ask you this other question from a listener. If coronavirus is a viral infection, will antibacterial measures like hand sanitizers, will that help?
The alcohol-based hand sanitizers are excellent for this very fragile virus. So absolutely. If you're listening in your workplace, look around. Where's your Purell? Where's your product that you're going to be able to clean your hands after you shake someone else's hands? It's a fragile virus, and we can use routine cleaning and routine products to try to prevent contamination of our hands, where we then inoculate ourselves or infect ourselves by touching our face.
Mm-hmm. And what someone's also asking about, how safe are we from the coronavirus passed in pool water? Maybe someone's concerned about swimming at the gym and wondering if it could be transmitted through pool water.
I don't want to start every question with, we don't know much about this novel virus, but I will speculate that, again, what we do know is it's a fragile virus, and it is adapted to be in respiratory secretions. That's where it wants to be and stay intact. And as soon as it's out of that, it falls apart pretty quickly. So a pool seems like a very bad environment for a virus like this.
So fragile enough to say, like, we're concerned about door handles, right? Surfaces that people touch a lot. So it wouldn't survive long on a door handle, in your view? Or we don't know? It's because there's so much we don't know. I don't know. You tell me.
Yeah. We have some studies of very closely related viruses, the coronaviruses that cause common colds, for example. So we know that they have a capacity to stay intact in a nest of secretion. So if somebody has contamination on their hands, that it's protected, and then you touch that doorknob, it can retain some ability to infect somebody through that what we call fomite transmission. Again, important to keep cleaning in a routine way all those commonly touched surfaces like desks and keyboards and doorknobs and handrails.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Chen.
Yeah, so I just want to mention that this is a new coronavirus, right? We just have first heard about this a little over a couple of months ago when the outbreak began in China and has since spread to multiple other parts of the world. But coronaviruses are a large family of different viruses, and so we have experience from dealing with past coronaviruses. And I think it's important to mention to your audience that there are routine circulating coronaviruses that people normally come into contact with every year. There are four different coronaviruses that are estimated to cause up to a quarter, that's about 25% of all common colds in adults worldwide. So people in the community may hear about, so-and-so got a coronavirus. We're not talking most of the time about this new coronavirus, right? There are naturally occurring, commonly occurring coronaviruses that people can commonly get colds from. We also have experience with a couple other newer emerging coronaviruses, the SARS coronavirus back in 2002, the MERS coronavirus back in 2012. These are related but different coronaviruses that we have experience responding to in public health.
So we're really specifically talking today about COVID-19. Coronavirus is a broad category, and it's not necessarily a new word.
Correct.
Okay. Let's go to the phones and talk to Deb in Alton. Deb, thanks for calling. What's your question?
Yes, hi. My question is, when people are told to stay indoors because they've been infected or near someone, isn't there something that we can do, or isn't there someone that can make them stay indoors? For instance, this person that was in New Hampshire that was told to be in quarantine, and then they went out to an event where there were 200 or 300 people there. That just does not seem right.
Well, Deb, thank you for the call. And just for a little bit of context, so this person was told or advised by his doctor to self-quarantine, not told by the state to self-quarantine. So he wasn't, as far as I understand, Dr. Chen, Dr. Talbot, maybe Jason, you want to weigh in, under any legal obligation to stay home. It may have been wise to stay home, but no legal obligation. Right, Jason, you're nodding?
That's accurate as far as I understand. Now that person is under legal obligation to stay at home, as I understand as well. So there is the state does have legal authority. The commissioner of health in New Hampshire can force people into quarantine in a public health emergency. I'll throw it to Dr. Chen and add a question if I could. Will we begin to use that legal authority on a preemptive basis going forward, given what happened when we just asked this person to quarantine?
So maybe a quick point on terminology. I think this has been a point of confusion. We talk about isolation. We talk about quarantine. Isolation is what we do to patients that are symptomatic. So if somebody becomes sick, we isolate them, either in the hospital if they're sick enough to require hospitalization, or at home if they're not. Quarantine is what we do for people that may have been exposed to a disease and are at risk of coming down with that disease, but are not yet symptomatic. And so your caller is talking about the situation where our first case of COVID-19 in New Hampshire was asked to self-isolate. There was no legal order served at that point. But the public health agency has public health powers to get people to comply with isolation and quarantine both. Most of the time when we deal with these situations, most people voluntarily self-isolate or voluntarily self-quarantine, and we don't have to go down the legal route. But we certainly have the ability and the option of serving a legal order to get people to comply, and that happened in the case of the first individual. The decision to use a legal isolation or quarantine order is usually done on a case-by-case basis, but I will say that anybody that we are isolating because of concern for COVID-19 or quarantining because they've been exposed to someone with COVID-19 is undergoing monitored supervision by our public health nurses to make sure that they are, in fact, complying with isolation and quarantine.
Dr. Talbot.
Following that, there was an important announcement yesterday that as the number of cases increase in countries other than China, we have new hotspots where transmission appears to be prevalent in the community, such as Iran, Italy, and South Korea. So the announcement yesterday was that people returning from those sites should self-quarantine. This is really a new era, and I think we should talk about that together, what that means. But we want that message out. We can't know who came back from Italy a few days ago. This is not something mandatorily reported. But we hope that we are living in a society where we can facilitate that important step for people to make sure they can stay at home, for example, from school, from work, and that they're not certainly pressured to overcome that. So this we have to think through together how that's going to work. But people returning from Italy, South Korea, and Iran should keep themselves at home in for the 14 days following their last exposure in those settings where there appears to be very widespread transmission.
Yeah, and I just to chime in on that, that's really important because that's new, right? Prior to yesterday, it was just travelers returning from China.
Exactly.
Though some schools in the state had asked people returning from Italy, so that was sort of a step above the CDC guidelines. Now it's very much in line with the guidelines. And just another quick note on that, in terms of which countries people should be self-isolating after travel to, we just listed a bunch, but the list might change. And so what's more important is not to remember the list of countries we just said, but to go to the CDC travel advisory website. You can look at the list of level 3 travel advisory countries because it will be fluid. It might not be the countries we just mentioned. If I could, Dr. Chan, do we have the number of people who are currently in self-isolation right now in New Hampshire? Do we have a sense of how many people are being monitored?
I don't have that current number that I can accurately repeat now, but there are certainly a handful of individuals that are either under self-quarantine, and then the two individuals with COVID-19 who are obviously under self-isolation, and they are complying with that.
Dr. Talbot or maybe Dr. Chan, one listener asked, if a family member is quarantined at home, is everyone stuck there as well, or do the family members go somewhere else?
Really, thanks for that question. It's one we're getting very commonly. So, no, contacts to contacts or contacts to people who are on quarantine do not need to restrict their movement. It's important, too, to hear that is, if there were such a recommendation, it could be somewhat disabling. So we certainly weigh risk-benefit collectively. You know, we can't put everyone on quarantine, can we? But we want to put those that are at the potentially identified highest risk of coming down with disease that might be contagious to others. So no, family members to people who are on quarantine do not need to also self-quarantine.
Dr. Chan.
And I think it's worth repeating again, I think that, again, this virus is primarily transmitted, excuse me, from an individual who's showing symptoms of disease through close contact. That's respiratory droplet spread. And so someone that may have traveled to Italy, for example, and come back and are not symptomatic or do not pose a risk, we believe, to the public or their family members. And so while we're asking the individual that traveled to self-quarantine, their family members and close contacts certainly do not need to restrict their movement. That would obviously change if the person, or could potentially change if the person became symptomatic and we initiated testing on the traveler. But someone who's asymptomatic is not considered a risk. The family members of people who are asymptomatic are not considered a risk to the general public.
Mm. Dr. Talbot, did you want to weigh in?
Yes. Absolutely, echo. And it raises an issue that's coming up a lot for those of us who are in the clinical trenches. There are a lot of smart people out there, I'm sure, listening right now, and a lot of isn't it possible and couldn't it happen that, and even we've had the question about the swimming pool. I think collectively we need to put our focus on where we know transmission is most likely and how we can make the greatest impact with limited resources, right? So we're going to follow the science closely and continue to reiterate that this epidemic is being driven by symptomatic people. And that's our target. Is it possible you could transmit 5 minutes before you recognize a symptom? Yes. But is it worth the intense effort in disabling our society by encapsulating that in some of our protocols? No.
Listeners, give us a call if you have questions or comments about coronavirus, 1-800-892-6477. You can also email us, exchange@nhpr.org. We're going to be talking about testing later in the program. We'll also be talking about travel. If you have questions about that or other things, again, 1-800-892-6477. Let's talk to Megan in Portsmouth. Megan, thank you very much for calling. What's on your mind?
Oh, hi. I was wondering, I had read online on a semi-reliable source, I would say, that seemingly young children are not getting sick, which is unusual because usually it's like the elderly and the very young that are, you know, most susceptible to these kind of things. And that maybe it's because kids are just petri dishes anyway, so they have better immune systems to these kind of coronaviruses that cause the common cold. I don't know. Is that true?
We'll put it to our panel. Thank you very much, Megan. Appreciate the question. Dr. Talbot, you wanted to answer that?
Well, we do appreciate the question, and I think many of us are very relieved that our vulnerable children, usually vulnerable children, are not particularly prone to getting serious disease from COVID-19. We don't fully understand that, so I do have to give that nod. But what's the data that we have out of China are multiple analyses of tens of thousands of the first cases that show us that indeed most of the severe cases are in people over 15 years old. We don't know whether there's minimally symptomatic or even asymptomatic disease in that age population, and we won't know that until our testing capabilities are improved to a place where we can see if people have antibodies is one way. But right now, our test detects people who have virus in their throat and their nose, and we're only testing people who are symptomatic. So we don't know really what's going on in the youngest population yet.
Jason.
While we're talking about different demographics of people contracting the virus, what can we tell listeners about who is most at risk? Who should we be most concerned about protecting from COVID-19?
Really, thank you for that, Jason. That's very important for us to understand together. Is again, that data coming out of places that are more mature in their epidemics suggests that the people who are at the highest risk of needing hospital support or even mechanical ventilation or to die from disease are those in the older age bracket. So also those who are with underlying diseases like diabetes, hypertension, cardiovascular disease, it appears that the disease course may be more severe for those.
Dr. Chen?
Yeah. I was also going to add that, as Dr. Talbot mentioned, we're still learning about the full extent of how people present with this infection. The vast majority of people, and we've seen this in studies coming out of China. There was an article published in the Journal of the American Medical Association just last month looking at, I think, over 72,000 infections in China. And more than 80% of people presented with more mild illness. But it is important to remember that this is a new virus, and we know it can spread easily person to person, and we know it can cause serious disease. People can end up in the hospital. People can end up in the intensive care unit. It can cause death. And the populations that are particularly vulnerable are those who are older, primarily, and people with multiple other medical conditions, which make them susceptible to these more serious complications if they become infected.
We got a question from Michael by email who asked, what is the lethality rate as compared to the flu?
Yeah, that's a question that we get frequently, and I think it's helpful for people to hear how it compares to other viruses, right? So this 2019 new coronavirus is related to some past coronaviruses like SARS in 2002 and MERS in 2012, and it certainly appears to be much less lethal or fatal than some of these past coronaviruses. The percentage of people who died from SARS was about 10% of people who got infected with the 2002 SARS coronavirus ended up dying. With the MERS coronavirus, upwards of 30 to 35% of people ended up dying after infection. From reports we're getting looking at infections of this new coronavirus coming out of China and worldwide, that number for this new coronavirus is about 1 to 2%. Perhaps closer to 2%, so significantly less fatal than some of these past coronaviruses that we've seen that we believe jumped from animals to humans, but certainly potentially more fatal or lethal than just regular seasonal flu. The number that's oftentimes quoted for seasonal flu is that about up to 0.1% of people during a regular flu season who get influenza can prove fatal in those individuals. So spreads more easily than some of these other past coronaviruses like SARS and MERS, but is less fatal. But certainly we're taking it seriously because it can be more serious than just a typical seasonal flu.
Is it also kind of scarier because we don't have a vaccine yet?
That's a great point and something we should I think talk more about. There are differences with even though this spreads very similarly to seasonal flu, we think through infected respiratory droplets. There are differences with how we respond to this. Right, with seasonal flu, we have a vaccine that can help prevent illness and need for hospitalization. We have medications that can treat seasonal influenza if someone becomes infected. We don't have those what we call pharmaceutical interventions or pharmaceutical measures to protect against this new or novel coronavirus.
I see. Okay. And Dr. Talbot, did you want to say something?
Well, I certainly want to follow with
sure.
We don't have them yet. You know, so
okay,
I want to
yes.
be giving people some talking points, right, in their own communities to understand that we're on fast tracks for vaccine right now. I think that it's a very reasonable estimate to say it'll likely be a year before you can roll up your sleeve kind of thing. But also tools against this virus include treatments. So there's a whole lot in the pipeline of treatments right now. More than 100 studies of some very well-known drugs being applied to this, and then some less well-known drugs that really have a very nice signal for potentially helpful for those who do become ill with disease.
We've got to take a quick break, but when we come back, we will talk more about the coronavirus. We'll talk about testing. We'll talk about travel, what you should think about if you're thinking about traveling. We'll also think about how the coronavirus is impacting people who have a disability. If you have questions about the coronavirus, concerns you'd like to air, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also email us. The address is exchange@nhpr.org, or check us out on Facebook. Just search for NHPR Exchange. That's all one word on Facebook. We're broadcasting a live streaming video. You can watch there and ask your questions there as well. I'm Peter Biello. This is The Exchange. We'll be right back. Tomorrow on The Exchange, Manchester Mayor Joyce Craig joins us for an update on the goings-on in the Queen City. She'll also brief us on the city's preparations for coronavirus. Right now, we're talking about the state's response to the coronavirus, asking for your questions or comments. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. We are also on Facebook Live. You can comment as you watch the video stream. We'll bring your comment in the conversation there as well. With us in the studio, Dr. Benjamin Chan, state epidemiologist for New Hampshire, Dr. Elizabeth Talbot, infectious disease specialist at Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center, and Jason Moon, NHPR's healthcare reporter. And I do want to remind our listeners that we are pausing our March fun drive this hour to bring you this conversation uninterrupted. You can support this type of programming right now by going to nhpr.org, and thank you very much. We want to bring a caller into the conversation. Let's talk to Morgan in Cape Natick, Maine. Thank you very much, Morgan. What's on your mind?
Hi, I'm calling. I'm wondering what your advice is regarding international travel outside of those three hotspots you mentioned previously. Is it irresponsible to continue with travel plans? Should we be considering whether we might be healthy individuals but might be carriers, or any advice for travel international in the next few weeks?
International travel, what do you think?
The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, is giving us very clear language around how to frame decisions about travel to the hotspots, as you call it, Morgan, sorry. So do not travel, you know, sort of those are very strong recommendations. It's very clear what that means. That's level three. But everybody will weigh risk benefit differently in that. And if you have to travel, if this really feels as though it's something that has to happen, then we are asking you with all energy to comply with the recommendation to quarantine yourself on return. Certainly be in touch with us if the health department, if you are ill on return or become in the 14 days that you are keeping yourself away from others who might be vulnerable to disease. It gives me an opportunity to remind you that the health department number for such reports is 271-4496 in the New Hampshire jurisdiction. I think I heard from you, Morgan, you were calling from Maine, so it would be a different number. But I know that Dr. Chan will want to follow up on that.
So is the CDC recommendation do not travel anywhere or just
to... Just to those places that are listed very clearly on their travel advisories.
And are those other countries, you mean? Because the question, I think, was about international travel.
Sure. So, yeah, international travel is not recommended against.
Okay.
But only the hotspots.
Only the hotspots. Dr. Chan.
Yeah, I was going to clarify that point as well, that, you know, as of right now, the recommendations from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, who is obviously monitoring the global situation very closely, has travel advisory notices for only a handful of countries, right? Level three travel advisory is, you know, avoid all non-essential travel. That's for the countries of China, Iran, South Korea, and Italy. There's a level two travel advisory notice, which is, you know, people that are more vulnerable, you know, our elderly population, people with multiple medical conditions should not travel to level two travel advisory countries. Currently, that's only, I believe, Japan. And then there's travel one advisory countries, which is there's no recommendation against travel, but there is a notice that there has been some limited community transmission. So people should travel with that in mind, right? So that's a handful of countries for which there is a travel notice. There's a whole many other countries that people could travel to for which there are no travel notices. And I think that gets to the caller's question, which is what should they do about travel to those other countries? And I think it's difficult to come up with a broad or blanket statement around travel because risk really depends on the individual and their willingness to potentially travel and take the risk of going to a country where there may be increasing transmission of COVID-19. And so I think that these decisions really need to be made on an individual case-by-case basis with the knowledge that this is a rapidly changing outbreak. And so if someone goes even to Europe, you know, there are other countries in Europe with, you know, increasing numbers of COVID-19 detected. There is not a recommendation not to travel. That's two negatives there currently, but the situation is changing so rapidly that new countries could be added to the travel notice list in the coming days, and people need to monitor that closely, and that's able to be accessed on the CDC website.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Talbot, you wanted to weigh in?
We're in an unusual space for the observation of the disaster of the Westerdam and the Diamond Princess cruises. There is travel advice regarding cruises to Asia, and I think that feels obvious, having observed what happened with the Diamond Princess and other cruises that did go to Asia. So I think that also should be a reminder. You know, cruises to Asia right now are recommended against.
We'll be talking a little bit more about travel in a moment, but I did want to bring in Stephanie Patrick, Executive Director of the Disability Rights Center. Stephanie, thank you very much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
You work with people who have disabilities, including people who may require home health aides or regular assistance in their daily lives. So what immediate impacts are you seeing, either as a result of the coronavirus or as people prepare for its possible spread?
Well, I think that we are monitoring the situation too. We've been in touch with the Department of Health and Human Services, who I know is working on it. But you know, we do have specific concerns for people with disabilities. I think that there's a lot of conversations about people with disabilities and others who may have compromised immune systems or other medical conditions and how they're more at risk. The other part of the conversation that I think is not getting as much attention as maybe it needs is the plans for people with disabilities who do require that day-to-day care. You know, that would include people with disabilities who are in nursing homes and other facilities. I know that the major part of the outbreak in Washington State is in a nursing home, and you know, how to maintain the care for the people that live there and make sure that the people that are the staff and the other patients are quarantined when they need to be. I think it's also really critical for people who get care in their homes, who need support and help to toilet, to bathe, to eat. And those are things that you can't just not do for 7 or 14 days while your regular direct care staff is quarantined. So I think it's really critical that as part of this conversation, we're thinking about how to make sure that these services are maintained, you know, because you can't go without.
And so what changes are being made for folks who have disabilities, particularly maybe in long-term assisted care facilities, nursing homes? Are there different standards or procedures being put in place right now to make sure those people are protected?
As far as I know, I think that they are they're following the regular protocols. I mean, there are already standard protocols because people with disabilities and others who are in these kinds of facilities are at risk for flu, they're at risk for colds, they're at risk for a lot of diseases. So they're following those, but I think it's just ramped up and getting more attention to make sure that they all have access to all the sanitizers they need, that everyone's washing their hands properly, and that the administrations of these agencies and these and families and others who are kind of thinking through this are making sure that they do have a plan in place. I mean, we know you've talked on the exchange many times about the workforce shortage and how it's a real struggle to make sure that there are people to fill all the jobs here in New Hampshire. And I think the direct care workforce and the home health workforce is really feeling that too. So there's often not that many people extra to do this work.
Mm-hmm. So what are your long-term plans for dealing with the coronavirus in assisting people who may have disabilities?
Well, we're continuing to monitor it. We're talking to the state and to other providers as best we can to make sure that they're covered. You know, we're reaching out and making sure that the issues impacting people with disabilities really get the attention that they need. The other one that I think is really critical just to mention here is making sure that communication for people with disabilities is available. So people who are deaf, who are blind, people who maybe can't read things on the website, that you're providing communication in multiple ways. And so we're doing our best to be able to do that and point that out to be sure that everyone, including people with disabilities, can access the information they need.
Stephanie Patrick, Executive Director of the Disability Rights Center, thank you very much for speaking with me. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
This is The Exchange on NHPR. We're asking you to send us your questions or give us a call if you have questions about coronavirus. It's been top of mind lately and the lead story almost in every newscast here at NHPR because it is a big deal both for New Hampshire and for the country as a whole. We were talking about travel just a moment ago, about international travel. I wanted to ask you, maybe Jason, you know this because you've been looking at the CDC guidelines. What about domestic travel? Are there any concerns about domestic travel, particularly maybe for Washington State, where there have been the most deaths in the country from COVID-19?
To my knowledge, and correct me if I'm wrong, CDC is not issuing any domestic travel guidance at this point. You know, that said, I think it's, you know, people could use common sense in terms of whether to visit you know, certain parts, certain very particular parts of the country that have ongoing community outbreak. But again, that's one of those things that could maybe potentially change, and that's why it's just important to check the CDC travel advisories before you travel, and not, you know, what we say here today on air may be out of date a week from now, 3 days from now, a month from now.
Fast moving for sure. We get this question from Kathy, who wrote, "My niece works in the Amazon Brazil office in Seattle. Since one of her colleagues has tested positive for COVID-19, she is now working from home. She is pregnant and due April 29th. What is her risk of complications if she becomes infected?" Dr. Talbot?
There was a report from China looking at only 10 pregnant women and their outcomes. So I think that intuitively, you know, we know that this is a vulnerable population. Women who are pregnant can sometimes have worse outcomes with infections because of what's happening with their immune system as they carry a child. So I think that indeed, looking to protect this population, pregnant women in our society, makes sense. But I would say we don't really have the data we want in order to make good counsel to those folks. Like, what are the chances of a bad outcome for the mother or the child? But sorry to hear you're dealing with that, Kathy.
Mm-hmm. We get this question from Abby in Amherst. Her question is, can you please shed some additional light on the wearing of masks? I do keep hearing that they don't really help, and the only people that should wear them are those that are already symptomatic. I understand why they would certainly not eliminate transmission, but why would the regular wearing of masks not dramatically prevent transmission? Dr. Talbot?
Let me get started, and I know Dr. Chan will want to say this here, too. So a few prefacing comments, right? Thank you very much for this question, Abby, because it's one that I get regularly, and I would love to talk about and come to some talking points together. There's very clear recommendations that asymptomatic persons in routine life should not wear masks. There's several reasons for that. First, that this is, as Dr. Chan said, a droplet-transmitted disease, meaning that it's not moving about in the air in a way that mask might help you, but rather the mask may serve to protect you from auto-inoculating if you're in a place of heavy transmission or where you can touch contaminated surfaces.
What do you mean auto-inoculating?
Exactly. So I was about to share that we use that phrase to mean that we touch our face 100 times an hour. You know, we don't even think of it often.
Way too often, it seems.
Exactly. So maybe more appropriate would be to tie our hands behind our back. But indeed, touching a surface and touching our eye, touching our nose, touching our mouth is how we inoculate ourselves. So you can imagine the logic of a mask in places where there is very active community transmission is that it prevents that moment. So that is a start to a conversation that I hope we can have more deeply right now.
And I'll just add to that and reiterate again that wearing of masks is not recommended as a way to prevent infection in the general, otherwise healthy public. you know, as Dr. Talbot mentioned, there are multiple ways of introducing this virus into your body, right? One way is breathing, you know, infected droplets from someone else. Another way is touching a surface that an infected person recently touched, and then touching your, you know, eyes, mouth, nose. That can introduce the virus into your body. And, you know, some people may wonder, well, why is touching your eyes a risk for getting a respiratory virus? Well, you know, the human physiology of this is that you have a duct called the nasolacrimal duct, which, getting a little scientific-y here, that connects your eyes to the back of your nasal passages, right? So if you're touching your eyes or someone coughs or sneezes into your eye, that virus can be transmitted from your eyes into your nasal passages. And this is part of the reason that when someone is being evaluated who's symptomatic in the healthcare setting, there's a whole set of personal protective equipment that a healthcare provider is asked to wear to protect themselves and the healthcare infrastructure. That includes not just a mask, but gloves, gown, good hand hygiene, and eye protection. And so, you know, the general public simply wearing a surgical mask has not been shown to be highly effective at, you know, reducing transmission in the community, and it reduces the supply of surgical masks that are necessary for people who are going into the doctor's office and symptomatic, for example, and the supply for the healthcare setting.
So, Jason, I wanted to get you to weigh in a little bit about the shortage of masks. Is there a shortage?
Yeah, well, I mean, we've seen reporting about that at a national level, and certainly there's the kind of compounding issue that there's an increase demand on masks and other, you know, healthcare items, protective healthcare gear from folks in the United States, Europe, elsewhere. There's also a reduced supply because a lot of these things are manufactured in the countries that are seeing the worst of the outbreak right now. So you're sort of getting it on both ends. So, yeah, I think that is certainly, you know, there's what the virus does, and then there's what our reaction to the virus does, and there's negative potential impacts from both of those things. I wonder to the doctors here, would it be just a easy rule of thumb to say don't wear a mask unless a doctor tells you to? Would that be an easy way to advise the public on this?
I would advise that people who are symptomatic entering a healthcare setting should wear a mask. So all our facilities are positioning masks early in the course of being in a facility. So you don that mask then. Absolutely. So here's a doctor telling you when to wear a mask for sure. Mm-hmm. In the general public, not so good. I'd like to try to reconstruct the conversation of going out and buying masks as a self-protective moment. I don't think it is. I think more self-protective would be to maintain the supply of masks for our healthcare workers, our ambulance drivers, and everyone else so they don't then propagate the infection. So think of it as altruistic to not buy the mask, right, and self-protective to not buy that mask because that's what's going to protect society at this juncture.
Yeah, and so the question is going to come up, right? We don't have a vaccine yet for this new coronavirus like we do with influenza. We don't have medications yet to treat someone who is infected with COVID-19. We're saying for the general public who's otherwise healthy, you don't need to wear a mask. How can people protect themselves? And I think this goes back to the advice that's given every year at all times, especially during influenza season, is that the way people protect themselves is the same way we recommend people protect themselves every flu season. Right, it's important to minimize transmission between people. Right, we do that through social distancing. So people that are sick should stay home, should not go to school, they should not go to work until they're afebrile, that is without fever and feeling better. We advise people avoid close contact with somebody else who's sick. Frequent hand washing, right, because it's not just breathing in infected respiratory droplets, it's touching, you know, surfaces and touching your eyes and nose and mouth that can infect someone with any range of different viruses. And then it's important if someone perhaps has traveled and does come down with symptoms of fever or respiratory illness to call ahead to their provider office to get further evaluation and instruction. We want to avoid people that may be sick from walking into a healthcare provider's office and potentially exposing other people, whether it's flu or COVID-19. And so we recommend people call ahead.
Listeners, we're talking about the coronavirus today on The Exchange, COVID-19 as well, and taking your questions about it. If you have questions or comments, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. We're going to be talking a little bit more about testing, what is involved in testing of the coronavirus, but anything goes, really. This is your chance to get your curiosity satisfied. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org or check out our Facebook page. Just go to Facebook, search for NHPR Exchange. We're streaming a live video of this radio program today, and you can leave a comment there, and we'll bring you into the conversation that way. This is The Exchange. Change on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back.
From the seacoast to the Upper Valley, Monadnock to the Great North Woods, NHPR covers the stories that impact your community to help you stay connected to what's happening in every corner of the state. I'm Annie Ropeek, a reporter here at NHPR, and when you give $10 a month as a sustainer, you'll help support a vital resource that is statewide, regional, and deeply New Hampshire. Give today at nhpr.org.
This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, and today we're talking about the coronavirus and efforts across the state to respond to cases already here and prepare for what's to come. With me in the studio today, Dr. Elizabeth Talbot, infectious disease specialist at Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center, Dr. Ben Chan, state epidemiologist for New Hampshire, and NHPR's healthcare reporter, Jason Moon. What do you want to know about the coronavirus and efforts to stop its spread and treat it? And please give us a call, 1-800-892-6477 or email exchange at nhpr.org. I just want to let you know as well that we're pausing our March Fund Drive for this hour because this is a very important topic. We wanted to bring it to you uninterrupted by fundraising breaks. But if you are interested in supporting this kind of programming, head on over to nhpr.org. And let's go to the phones and talk to Bob in Concord. Bob, thank you very much for calling. What's on your mind?
Good morning. Yes, I've been trying to find out for the last week or so exactly what the longevity of this virus is in different kinds of environments, whether humidity matters or not. And in particular, does this virus live longer if it's on a dry surface, or does it live longer if it's in a tub or a sink? Because now that, people keep saying, well, the virus is over in Italy and all that. The fact is, and I'm I'm sure people are well aware of this at this point, I would think, it's actually in New Hampshire. So just trying to figure out what the smart things are to do with respect to that.
So let's put that to the panel. Dr. Chan?
Yeah, so I think I just want to make the point that we have detected this virus that causes COVID-19, this new coronavirus, in New Hampshire. There is not evidence of wider spread community transmission, right? The first individual that we announced who tested positive this past Monday traveled to Italy. So it's a travel-related case. The second individual was a known and identified close contact of our first infection, the first person identified with infection. Mm-hmm. And so the purpose of our public health investigation is to identify people that are close contacts to these people with identified infection so we can self-quarantine them and try and prevent further transmission in the community.
So you're talking about people-to-people transmission.
Correct.
Bob may have been concerned about, like, is it going to stay, for example, on a wet sink in a public bathroom longer than, say, a dry desk surface that multiple people use, for just as an example?
Yeah, right. So from what we – and – let me say first that we're still learning about this virus, and one of those areas that we're still learning about is how long this virus can survive on surfaces, for example. But from what we know of our study of past coronaviruses like SARS in 2002 and MERS in 2012, is that these viruses are very susceptible to drying out, right? So when they dry out, they usually die pretty quickly. So we've gotten questions of, you know, people shipping packages from China. Is it a concern for transmitting the virus? Generally, no. And I think we keep going back to how is this primarily transmitted? It's primarily transmitted through close contact with someone who is infected or touching a surface like a doorknob or a handle of someone who was infected and recently came by and touched that surface, right? When someone's respiratory secretions are put on a door handle and it dries out, we don't believe that the virus survives for a long period of time. But I don't know if Dr. Talbot has any other thoughts on that.
I think it's a common question. Is there going to be a seasonality to this virus, as there is for flu and some of the other cold viruses? Well, we hope so, because we're, of course, coming into spring. But we don't know that. And there have been models of respiratory viruses that haven't paid any attention to the temperature or the humidity. So I think that it's as Dr. Chan said, we've said several times, it's not very sexy. But we are looking at the majority ways that this is transmitted. It's person to person. And so hand hygiene. Look around now. Where's your Purell? You know, do you have it in your car? Do you have it in your purse? Do you have it on your desk? That it's, again, I know people glaze over when we say it, but that's the best mileage here. That's where you're going to make the best protection and bang for your buck, if you will.
Let's talk a little bit about testing. We get a question from someone who didn't want to use their name. This person says, I'm a hospital nurse in New Hampshire, not Dartmouth-Hitchcock. We have lots of patients who come to the ER or are admitted to the hospital with flu-like symptoms. Should all these patients be tested for coronavirus, or only those with probable exposure to corona or pertinent travel history? Dr. Talbot.
Could I kick it off? And I think we'll have to go back and forth a
sure.
few times. So let me make reference to where we are at this stage of the epidemic in the United States, and that's with a heavy emphasis on containment. So identifying those who still have obvious risk factors for disease. But we have made a subtle change that if you have a patient who's been investigated in usual ways for a severe respiratory illness, we will test those folks. But right now, there is not widespread testing capacity. We hope for it. But as it is now, we are using common sense and testing those who have risk factors or have unexplained severe illness that could possibly represent a signal for community transmission. And Ben?
Yeah, so what we really would like to see is testing for COVID-19 commercialized, right, so that healthcare providers can get the testing through their normal medical routes. Right now, however, testing is only being conducted through public health agencies and at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. So that, by nature, limits testing. So what we have asked providers is that anybody presenting to the healthcare setting or calling in to the healthcare setting who may be complaining of fever or any respiratory illness be screened, be asked questions about recent travel, specifically to travel to one of these highest risk countries like China, South Korea, Iran, Italy, Japan, And if there's concern for travel or contact with someone with known COVID-19, if there are these identified risk factors and they're having symptoms consistent with COVID-19, which are primarily fever and lower respiratory tract symptoms of cough and shortness of breath, that these individuals, if they're in the healthcare setting, be roomed appropriately, that providers use appropriate protective equipment when they're seeing them, and then call the Division of Public Health Services to talk through whether testing may be warranted or not. Because testing is not widespread through normal medical routes, there is a process in place that providers need to go through to identify those who we think are at risk so that we can initiate testing.
Mm-hmm. We got this comment from someone a couple of weeks ago. I bought a few N95 masks at a paint store, not surgical masks. Now that I hear about the shortage in the medical community, I think perhaps that was selfish and I feel guilty about it. So is there a place I can donate them now? I only have about 5 or 6. That's Jamie in Epping wants to donate some masks.
God bless you, Jamie. That's a very altruistic impulse. I think that your 5 or 6 are probably not going to turn the tide, but hold on to them should recommendations change.
Okay.
So thank you for that.
Certainly. Okay. We got this one from Lauren in Guilford who says, I am an ER physician. I appreciate the health alert networks shared by CDC that the state has sent out, but could you please make them a daily routine? Mm-hmm. The recommendations seem to change daily, and I'm having a hard time keeping up with the recommendations, such as case definition, testing kits, et cetera. Are we advised now to test all pneumonias regardless of exposure history? So a couple questions there. Daily HANs, and are we advised now to test all pneumonias?
That's a great question. We have sent out 5 health alert network messages to providers over the last month or so, so that they seem to be coming at least on a weekly basis. And we have, because recommendations and situations changing so rapidly, we're trying to push out as much information as quickly as possible to providers. I will mention that we are planning on another health alert network message in the next day or so because of these changes. So I think the comment from the ER physician is well taken. We recognize the need for more information. And just for your general audience, a health alert network message is one of the primary ways that we communicate with our clinician audience, not just physicians, but PAs, nurse practitioners, nurses. So this is a primary way that we push out information and recommendations to physicians, and we recognize that this is changing rapidly, and we need to be putting out routine recommendations, and we are doing that.
Lauren also wanted to know, is the State Department of Health and Human Services staffed 24 hours a day, since many of us work the night shift, adding she would appreciate more frequent updates so that I have answers for patients. 24 hours a day?
Yes.
It is 24 hours a day. Okay.
The other thing that's happening at the health department, which I think is very appropriate, is institution of a daily call. So it's basically a call-in with the likes of Dr. Chan and myself and other knowledgeable partners so that you can ask your questions directly. So really, thank you for that question.
Okay. So Anna wants to know, how many test units are in New Hampshire, Concord State Test, universities, commercial sites? How many tests are available? Do you know?
That's a great question, and it's changing. We have word that the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is going to be pushing out many more test kits, or rapidly increasing the testing capacity. So right now, our public health laboratory is able to do the COVID-19 testing. They can do that from test kits sent to us from the CDC. So the CDC is the one that works to manufacture these, pushes them out to the state and local health departments to do the testing. We are using an old kit, one that was sent to us that we just recently brought on. That has some limited capacity. With that one kit, we were able to test about 50 or so patients. But we hear that there are more test kits coming in the near future that will rapidly increase our test capacity.
Jason Moon.
On the issue of testing, we heard yesterday from Dartmouth-Hitchcock that they're trying to develop their own test. Do we have an update on the status of that? And if Dartmouth-Hitchcock begins to do its own testing, will those numbers be reported through the state? Will we treat them the same as the presumptive positive tests we're getting from public health? Will we have sort of 2 separate categories? I know it's getting a little complicated because having to wait for CDC confirmation of these. So how will all that work if there's multiple testing agencies in the state?
The COVID-19 will be a mandatorily reportable disease in the near future and probably the long future. But that means that these so-called lab-developed tests, which we welcome, we invite, will feed into our general knowledge of the movement of this disease in our population. In terms of your question, Jason, timing, I think it'll take several weeks before that can be brought on board, given scrutiny, to make sure that this test is done right. You know, so this is a national strategy that you'll see coming forward to bring people more testing capacity in the weeks to come.
Ernest wanted to know, wrote in by email, could you have your guests talk about whether symptoms of coronavirus would feel any different from the normal flu? Is it feeling? Can you tell just by what you have that, oh, this might be coronavirus or, oh, this is normal flu?
Generally, probably not, right? The symptoms of COVID-19 are very similar to many other respiratory viruses, including influenza, right? The primary symptoms are going to be fever, cough, possibly shortness of breath. Many people may also experience muscle aches, fatigue, just feeling generally run down. Upper respiratory tract symptoms like runny nose, sinus congestion, sore throat are certainly quite a bit less common than those symptoms I just mentioned. And gastrointestinal symptoms like nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea are also pretty rarely reported in the literature.
Mm-hmm. One listener asked, do all New Hampshire hospitals have the proper staff, education, and equipment to handle a cluster outbreak, Dr. Chan?
So any hospital in New Hampshire and many healthcare providers, doctor's offices, are able to appropriately assess a patient and evaluate and test. We're working with hospitals to make sure that they are prepared to handle a potential influx of patients. That's one of the critical things we want to work with hospitals on, but it's important for people to remember that if they're having mild symptoms and no travel history, to simply stay home and, you know, until they're feeling better.
That's Dr. Benjamin Chan, state epidemiologist for New Hampshire. We've also been speaking with Dr. Elizabeth Talbot, infectious disease specialist at Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center, and NHPR's Jason Moon, healthcare reporter. Thank you all very much for being on the program today. We really appreciate it.
Our pleasure. Thank you.
I hope you'll do it again.
We've got so many questions about this that the conversation absolutely must continue on Facebook. So go to NHPR Exchange on Facebook. The questions will still be coming in there. You can also keep the conversation going at nhpr.org. If you missed any part of this discussion, you can go back and listen to it at nhpr.org/exchange and find the answers to the questions that our guests have already answered. We'll continue to cover this story because it's a big one. We really appreciate you tuning in today. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Michael Brindley is our program manager. Our regular theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and Rebecca Lavoie was working the cameras today. Engineer Dan Colgan. I'm Peter Biello, in for Laura Kanoy. Thank you very much for listening.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.